House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Criminal Law and Corrections, Tuesday, February 19th, 1991, 1 p.m., Hearing Room 357, Public Hearing and Possible Work Session.
I'd like to call the meeting of the Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Law and Corrections to order. On our agenda today are House Bills 2502, 2543, 2545, 2546, 2544, and 2542. I would counsel any other preliminary observations before we begin? All right, then we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2502. And I'd like to call Representative Mannix. Welcome, Representative Mannix, to the Criminal Law Subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be appearing in front of you today. I'm State Representative Kevin Mannix, representing District 32 in Central and Northeast Salem. I do request that I be allowed to have a couple other witnesses come up and join me, if that'll be all right.
Please.
Representative of the Sheriff's Association and a Multnomah County detective. I would just like to make a couple of introductory remarks and then ask if the other witnesses can introduce themselves and follow up from there. House Bill 2502 is an extension of a concept that was passed last session. Last session, we set up a special standard for criminal laws and in regard to law enforcement and drugs when it came to our children and our schools. We enhanced the penalties for the delivery of a controlled substance to a student or minor within 1,000 feet of the real property comprising a public or private elementary, vocational, or secondary school. Now, there is another bill this session which will try to develop that concept further, perhaps in terms of colleges and universities, and perhaps in terms of manufacture of drugs, perhaps in terms of conduct involving adults only. But as to location, House Bill 2502 addresses the fact that we have certified daycare facilities in the state, and they're not protected by the special language of the law. So what this bill simply does is it addresses that issue and says that we want to certainly protect our even younger citizens from this kind of conduct with enhanced penalties. We've tried to draw a line around our schools and say, don't come in within this perimeter, within the 1,000 feet of the school. We don't want you dealing drugs with our kids, and this bill simply expands that to include a daycare facility.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. We'll forego our questions until the other witnesses have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Russ Spencer, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And rather than give you just the broad law enforcement philosophical arguments as to why this is a good idea, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Lieutenant John Bunnell from Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, who is going to explain to you that there are some philosophical as well as some very important practical reasons why this is an important bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Mr. Bunnell? Lieutenant Bunnell?
Thank you. Primarily why I'm here today, speak from a selfish point of view, I'm in favor of any penalty enhancement, especially when it aids me in law enforcement endeavors, especially with those with regards to narcotics and dangerous drugs. I currently am commander of the narcotic and unit for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, which is a multi-agency task force which involves itself primarily with narcotic abuse problems, gambling, and vice problems in the city of Portland and Multnomah County. Another area that we're quite deeply involved with is drug abuse resistance education. And we're trying to send a message both to the kids that we encounter every day, but also to the parents and the other members of the community that we are going to have drug-free environment around schools and daycare centers. And we won't tolerate anything less than that. I know from my experience in dealing with narcotic offenders for the past 20 years that they are aware of drug enhancement penalties. They're very cognizant of them. Today, the biggest fear amongst the drug dealer is, one, the asset forfeiture law, and two, is he going to be prosecuted federally because of the enhanced penalties? I think we need an enhanced penalty in this area. I think it sends a positive message not only to our children, but it sends a positive message to those hundreds of people that are helping through community organizations and neighborhood groups that we, as representatives of the law, are supportive, that we believe in the philosophy of a drug-free environment, and we're not going to tolerate anything less. Basically, that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant. Are there questions of these witnesses?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Manning.
I do have one favor to ask. Lieutenant Bunnell has to leave early today, and there were a couple of other bills that he wanted to address generally in terms of comments. Would it be appropriate for him to just make some general remarks about those bills? Or I haven't asked the Lieutenant if he would like to do that, but if the committee would bear with him on that.
That would be fine with the committee.
The one bill I wanted to make comment to is House Bill 2545 with regards to the crime of child neglect in the first degree, involving situations in which there's manufacturing and I believe distribution of narcotics in a curtilage or house in which there are children involved. I can only speak from a point of view of what I observed firsthand. Probably the hardest thing that we have to deal with in narcotic enforcement are children in drug houses. And not a day goes by that we don't deal with this. Last night we had a semi-tragic experience in which we entered a fortified house with a SWAT team, and it necessitated eliminating a couple pit bull animals who attacked the officers involved. Fortunately, the three children that are associated with that house, ages 3, 7, and 9, were not there. It was planned accordingly to do the house so they wouldn't be there. But in talking to these children, they were quite aware of what their parents were doing. The parents were unemployed. They felt that their parents were involved in narcotics because they know their parents didn't work, but they'd come home with large sums of money every night. And what really brought the message home was the 7-year-old who told me a story of the day before yesterday. He was getting dressed to go to a daycare center, reached under his bed to get his tennis shoes, and came up with a needle stuck in his hand. And to me, that's a very tragic consequence. And again, I'm firmly supportive of this particular measure. I think it will send a very positive message, and again, it will have a most important bearing on probably our most important commodity, and that's our children.
Thank you very much. Was there another bill you wanted to speak to, Lieutenant?
No, not this time. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate
it. Mr. Chairman. If it's all right, I'd like to sit in with the committee for the rest of the hearing.
Representative Mannix, you are welcome here at all times. Speaking for the chair. Let me, Mr. Robeson, you did not want to testify on this particular measure. David Fedanke.
Put a demo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm David Fedanke, Associate Director, ACLU of Oregon, and I have given you a copy of an amendment that we have drafted that we hope the subcommittee will consider as it moves on this bill. We did not testify in the House on House Bill 2369 last session, but we did catch up to it when it got over to the Senate. Our concern was the possibility of disproportionate punishment. I'm sure you're all aware that currently the controlled substance statutes ascribe different penalties depending on where a substance falls in the schedule of controlled substances. Schedule 1 substances delivery is a Class A felony, Schedule 2 Class B felony, and on down the line. The Schedule 1 substances are very serious, but I think what many of us think of as being some of the most serious drugs that cause problems are in fact in Schedule 2, such as cocaine and methamphetamines. The purpose of our amendment is to apply this enhanced penalty only to Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 substances that in situations where those offenses would otherwise have been an A felony or a B felony. We think that would be more in line with proportionality and would be consistent with other statutes on the books. The statute that's currently on the books, in part because of our concerns, was amended on the Senate side last session to require that it apply only to delivery to a student or a minor within 1,000 feet of school property. We believe that was a positive change, would have rather seen an amendment similar to the one in front of you. But the bill that's before you today, because it would apply to all daycare centers, as that term is defined under state law, would include home care providers. We believe that that is a very large number of residences in the state of Oregon. 1,000 feet amounts to 3 1/3 football field length from that property. In effect, we think this bill is enhancing penalties for drug offenses, delivery of drugs, in a very wide swath across the state. And we hope the committee will act cautiously in that regard.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Verdenke. Representative Bryan.
Mr. Verdenke, did you just say that this bill would include daycare? The existing law?
No.
Okay.
The House Bill 2502 before you today would extend the current law to daycare, certified daycare facilities, as that term is defined in 418.805. And 418.805 defines daycare facility to mean any facility that provides daycare to children, including a day nursery, nursery school group, home of a family daycare provider, or similar unit operating under any name, but not including, and then it exempts a few places. I think it's clear that that family daycare providers are included under that definition.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bryan.
But of course you're not suggesting that it's okay to deliver controlled substances to only small daycare operations?
No, of course not. Representative, as I tried to point out, the delivery of most dangerous drugs is currently punishable as either a Class B or Class A felony already. We think the most reasonable approach would be to add those offenses for which it would be a B felony, that is the Schedule II substances, in certain circumstances. We don't think that 1,000 feet within vicinity of a home daycare provider is probably a very practical way to go. I assume, and as I think most of the committee knows, I'm not an attorney. I have spoken to a criminal defense attorney about this. I assume that one of the elements of the crime that would have to be proven would be the knowledge that the defendant was within 1,000 feet of either a daycare center or a home daycare provider. That is probably going to be very difficult to do. I understand from the state court administrator's office that in the first 9 months that the current statute was on the books, there were only 3 cases filed under the new statute, and all of those did not result in convictions.
Representative Mannix and then Representative Parks.
Well, now, one thing you've missed here is the word certified, because while you just read the definition of daycare facility under 418.805, you ignored the next statute, 418.810, which adds the extra language for certification. Most of these mom-and-pop and home daycare facilities are not certified, and we've had many battles in the legislature regarding certification, and we've tried to make sure that the little home operations don't have to be certified. So in case if it makes you more comfortable, the use of the term certified there was deliberately chosen, and it refers only to daycare facilities that have gone through the certification requirements of 418.810.
I stand corrected, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Parks.
I don't know who this is. Representative Mannix's bill. I don't think knowledge is an element of this crime. Is it? Isn't this just a prohibited act? And whether you knew it was a
strict liability crime.
Yes, right.
It's knowingly.
Representative Bauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you would have to knowingly be delivering a controlled substance. But the knowledge of the certified daycare center, you know, I guess I have a little bit of the same feeling that I had the other day when in the Family Justice Subcommittee we were working a registration of sex offenders bill, that we're just sort of getting there incrementally. I think that what we're doing is we're setting up a real sympathetic group of collateral victims of drug use, which are children who are of the tender age that you know would involve them in daycare centers. But I guess I don't see that that we shouldn't anticipate that there are some other special groups that are injured by the delivery of controlled substances. And if what the committee wants to do is enhance the penalty for the delivery of a controlled substance, just enhance the penalty for delivery of a controlled substance and not make us show up at every scene with a registry of a blue book or a registration of certified as opposed to not certified daycare centers. And, you know, your measuring tape that is 1,000 feet long. And is it 1,000 feet as the crow flies, or you know, if you have to go around objects, do you include that? I think, you know, the delivery outside of school addressed the situation of having, 12, 13, 14, 11, 9, that age of kids, be participants in a drug deal. What are we getting at? I suppose it's really a question kind of for you, Representative Mannix. I think it's also damaging that people are dealing drugs within 1,000 feet of a licensed eating establishment. So I don't want somebody who's been influenced by drugs that, you know, preparing meals for me or my children or my, you know, whatever, my constituents.
Sunday schools,
right. There you go. I mean, there are, I don't even think we need to search very long. I think if the committee took a few minutes, we could come up with some more classifications. But I think what we really are doing here is looking at enhancing or not enhancing the crime of unlawful delivery of controlled substances.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Mannix.
Well, since part of the question was addressed to me, my answer would be, if I had my druthers, we'd do it statewide. But we're talking about limited resources. So we have to have this gradually expanding target. And over the years, as we eliminate the scourge of drugs from our society, and as our resources for the fight increase, then we may also widen the scope. Someday I would hope we could do away with this statute entirely and have just the regular law in regard to delivery of controlled substances. But what we've gone through is a two-step process. Last session we said we're going to protect minors, and in terms of this delivery, and we're going to protect them within some range of schools. This bill just goes an extra step further and says we're also going to protect them within some range of certified daycare facilities. Frankly, if I had my druthers, you'd have in front of you a bill that takes away the requirement within schools and just says here's an enhanced penalty for delivery to minors. But I don't think in terms of resource allocation that we're there yet. I've tried to be consistent or aware of the concerns that have been expressed about resource allocation in the state. And yes, it's an enhanced penalty for a limited geographic region. We're trying to create drug-free zones in the state.
Representative Baum.
I kind of agree with what Representative Baum is saying. I think that what we're doing here is we might as well just go ahead and make all delivery Class A felony. The reason I say that is because subparagraph A talks about a student or minor, then subparagraph B is entirely related to place. I mean, I hope we aren't selling any service to any minors who are going to the daycare center. If we've lost that grip, then we're in big trouble. So my view is that I'm a little surprised, and I don't know how it happened, but I don't think it came out of this committee that we limited paragraph A to a student or minor. I don't think we did that last session. That was added by the Senate. And then somehow it came back and we concurred, I guess, which is kind of interesting. But what we do is that this is great because I have enough small little communities that have 1,000 feet, and you've essentially banned deliveries, and and they won't be delivering any drugs in those communities without an A felony coming around. So I'm just telling you that if you really want to get serious and send a message about this, that I think that you ought to just simply go for the dough.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
Although I may have some pride of authorship, I'm not shy about discussing the concept of expanding this bill and subtracting the geographic element and just saying any delivery to a minor anywhere is a Class A felony. Thank you very much.
That might be a potential there.
Mr. Chair.
David?
On that point, Mr. Chair, delivery of a Schedule 1 or a Schedule 2 controlled substance to a minor is already a Class A felony under ORS 475.995. That statute does then ratchet down for other controlled substances. And again, I would like to draw the committee's attention to what substances fall in those other portions of the schedule. Schedule 3 controlled substance, probably the most widely used, is Tylenol with codeine. The effect of this statute, this bill, if it were passed as proposed, would be that someone inside their house who happened to live within 1,000 feet of a certified daycare center who took Tylenol with codeine that had been prescribed to their spouse would be committing an A felony. I think it's pretty obvious that it's not the intention of this committee to go after folks in that kind of situation. Schedule 5 controlled substances, you're talking about cough syrups with codeine.
Representative Mannix.
If you're talking about an adult, it's just totally incorrect. It has nothing to do with this bill. We're talking about delivery to a minor.
Representative Mannix, with all due respect, your amendment...
I haven't amended anything.
...would not... Well, your amendment to the current statute in House Bill 2502 does not deal with delivery to minors.
Oh, yes, it does. Not my amendment, but the bill does. The law does.
The bill...
Please read line 6.
Is unlawful for any person to deliver a controlled substance within 1,000 feet of the real property.
To a student or a minor.
Well, that's current law.
Yeah.
Correct.
But that would that language apply to subsection B as well?
Oh, yes. Oh, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Okay. I see what you mean.
That was why that language was added, was to avoid it being applied to somebody who was sharing their Tylenol with codeine.
Well, we can clean it up.
We'd be happy to work with you.
Thank you, Mr. Podanky. Further questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2502?
For the record, my name is Rosanna Creighton, Executive Director of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon. And, Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me speak. I wasn't planning on testifying. I just have a few questions that are coming to my mind as others are testifying. The 1,000 feet of a bill, 1,000 feet of a school bill last session was one of our bills, and it was to create a true safety zone around our schools so our children, whether they're on the school playground or they're walking and being they're traveling back and forth from home to school, would not be encountering drug activity. Whether that delivery is an adult delivering to a minor or adults delivering to each other, it doesn't matter. We were trying to create a zone where they wouldn't be exposed to that activity. And we are introducing a bill to strengthen the current state law as the House passed it last session, and it was changed in the Senate. And thanks to Mr. Podanky, now I know why it was changed in Senate Judiciary. A question that comes to my mind when Mr. Podanky was testifying is he kept making reference to serious drugs in Schedule 1 and Schedule 2. And what I'm asking the committee, and I would like to know clarification, marijuana is a Schedule 1 drug, but in Oregon statutes they always say a Schedule 1 drug except for marijuana, and they've always kind of set it up as a separate condition. And in looking at Mr. Representative Mannix's bill, I just would like to know how Mr. Podanky's amendment would apply and how marijuana fits into this picture.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
I can ask a question.
Representative Baum?
You know, occasionally you've presented bills to this committee in the past and they've kind of got revamped. There's some feeling about doing that maybe today, if we ever got to that point in the work session. But what are we really doing here? I mean, the House sent this bill over to the Senate with the intent that anybody that delivers drugs for any reason within 1,000 feet of school should be got an A felony, whether it's adults or anybody. We just don't want that activity going on. Comes back and kind of a watered down, you got to catch them delivering it to a kid now. That's the law. Now we're going to go to daycare centers, which there's really going to be no delivery at daycare, we hope. And if it's the daycare workers, then they're adults and they should, you know, be treated harshly too. So we're kind of starting to mix geography with people. And if our message is we want to stop delivery of drugs in the state, why don't we just go to A, felonies, and that way the police don't have to get cute about yard measurements and where the daycare facility is in the school, and let the law enforcement people focus on the areas right around schools and focus on, have some legislative language to direct them to try to focus on the 1,000, you know, areas around schools to bust these drug houses and stuff, or just send a message that all drug delivery is an A felony.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Baum, I couldn't agree with you more, and I you know, philosophically, I'm with you 100%. And I have no idea what this committee will do. I would support that kind of effort. We've been hit with fiscal impact every time we try to do something that needs to be done. I just wanted to ask this committee to take a close look at what this amendment will do in the way they're dealing with marijuana, because everybody wants to handle marijuana separately from other illicit drugs. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, one more question, Rosanna. Representative Parks?
Well, I want to know what the answer to her question was. What's the practical effect of the amendment as it applies to marijuana? We're going to pass on that for a minute, so right. I just want to know. I think that's a good question.
I need a minute to answer the question.
We're having that researched, Representative Parks.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2502? Not, we'll close the work session, the public hearing on House Bill 2502. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2502 just to extract comments from the members, perhaps action.
Mr.
Representative Mannix.
I'm open to moving in a couple of directions. I do think, first of all, in terms of the original thrust of the bill, we were trying to talk about students or minors within 1,000 feet of a daycare facility, just as we were talking about them within 1,000 feet of a school. That would be a somewhat technical change to bring the thrust of the bill back to where I was talking about. And I do think, by the way, that there can be a problem with, for instance, youngsters who are working with daycare facilities who may have delivery of controlled substances to them. It may be a narrow problem, but we'd be addressing that. But I think Representative Baum has raised an interesting issue as to whether or not we should just move away from the geographical limitation. I like the idea of just saying for controlled substances generally, delivery to a, I would leave it to a minor. I don't know why we have to add student anymore. If we just said to a minor,
how about a person?
Under 18, it's Class A felony.
How about a person?
Well, I'm certainly open to that, Mr. Chairman. And maybe the compromises ought to be in the Senate. And we might as well
usually
have
where they are.
Cards and chips in our stack to deal with.
Well, I would be in favor of developing the best policy that we possibly can, and to the extent that others don't agree with us, we'll have an opportunity to visit with them. Oops. Representative Baum?
I'd still like to throw out for the committee consideration the concept of requiring that any delivery of a controlled substance in the state to, at the very least, of course, we have that for minors, but to any delivery, to any person, be considered a Class A felony.
Representative Baum, let me just ask, and maybe Representative Mannix, since, again, this is your bill, if we could get to where Representative Baum wants to go, that's one That's one issue. Number two is, did you want to create really this zone of special protection for our children? And I wonder, and I don't know how law enforcement would treat this, but obviously if it was enhanced in this particular area, maybe their vigilance is greater.
Mr. Chairman?
And maybe we almost dilute, if it is your effect, to try to protect further areas where children are. Maybe we dilute that by saying it is the same penalty for delivery anywhere.
Mr. Chairman, I do think that the one way to achieve the, I'll call it narrower focus, but a balanced approach here would be to take out the restriction on students or minors on 1,000 feet, a delivery to anybody within 1,000 feet of a school, or a delivery to anybody within 1,000 feet of a certified daycare facility is a Class A felony. That creates the zone, special zone of protection with enhanced penalties around schools and daycare facilities, and it means we won't have four-year-olds around adults delivering drugs to other adults. And that really furthers the social concept that this bill was all about. There will be another bill that can address, I think it's House Bill 2580, the broader question of manufacture and possession. This is just a delivery bill. And we'd have an enhanced penalty for any trading or dealing in drugs within 1,000 feet of places where kids congregate.
Window of a minimum of 5 years to whatever the maximum statutory indeterminate sentence would be. I would also point out, for the committee's information, and Representative Clark is here and might want to address this further, the Family Justice Subcommittee is working very diligently on a bill that would require sex offender registration, and it would cover the four offenses that are included in this bill. That's it for now.
Thank you, learned counsel. Representative Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kevin Mannix, state representative from District 32, covering Central and Northeast Salem. I will defer in a moment to Russ Spencer and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I simply wanted to say that House Bill 2543 is another bill in the right direction in regard to these kinds of offenders. I do think there's a distinction to be made in regard to this bill as compared to the bill which is in front of Family Justice. That has to do with registration of sex offenders and extension of the time in which they have to maintain their registration after their time of supervision has been completed, parole or probation. This bill deals with how long they ought to be under supervision, under parole or probation, and extends the time that they ought to be under supervision by saying that so long as that you have to remain under such supervision for the maximum indeterminate sentence that applies for the offense. That's the thrust of this bill, and it would involve extended supervision of offenders. There will probably be some discussion of a fiscal impact as a result of that, because you are going to have offenders who are going to be kept under supervision for a substantially longer time than they are right now. Again, I would distinguish this from the registration bill, which maintains information as to where the offender is located but does not maintain any program of supervision. And if I may, I'd otherwise defer to the other witnesses and join the committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Mannix. We'll defer the grilling of your testimony until later. Mr. McIntyre, Mr. Spencer, please. And perhaps Mr. Robson, do you want to come at this time with? All right, you're in the next wave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Russ Spencer. I'm representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association today. And the next series of bills that you're going to be hearing are sponsored at our request. Very briefly, I just want to let you know how these came about. We convened a task force made up of deputy district attorneys, sheriff's department investigators, some legislative personnel, and sheriffs to come up with a small package of bills that we felt would make a significant impact in helping our people to prosecute these cases and helping to protect the public safety. In doing so, we solicited input from every single sheriff and every single district attorney in the state of Oregon, as well as going through a number of meetings in order to craft what we thought and what we hope will be well thought out legislation. Other than that, I'm here to provide support for Mr. McIntyre, and I will throw him to you now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Mr. McIntyre.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2543 is intended to supplement the current treatment, actually, of sexual offenders and multiple victim pedophiles that have come within the purview of the criminal justice system through criminal conviction. We have found in the 80s, especially, and now that we're into the early 90s, that unfortunately this type of aberrant deviant behavior, not only does it exist, but it's extremely dangerous and extremely damaging. We found through the Oregon State Hospital treatment providers for the Forensic Treatment Program, through a number of other treatment providers within the Multnomah County area anyway, that are more and more joining the position that these people who reach the point where they're convicted of these types of offenses are, first of all, very difficult to treat, if they are treatable at all. And even if they are treatable, they are suffering from probably a lifetime problem that is going to require constant supervision with even intermittent intervention. It's the purposes of the House Bill 2543, as it's written, to extend the maximum period of time that these people can currently be held on probation and under supervision for treatment. Currently, as the committee is probably already aware, the maximum length of time for a felony conviction for probation is 5 years. That is whether or not it's a sex abuse in the first degree, which is a Class C felony, or whether it's a rape in the first degree, which is a Class A felony. If the person violates their probation or something occurs during the pendency of the probation that the court supervising the probation thinks that it should be extended, then the offender can, by order of court, be extended an additional year for a total of 6 years. Many of the inpatient residential sex offender treatment programs run for two to two and a half years before they release the patient into the community. Many of the outpatient outpatient treatment programs for sex offenders that occur within the community can run upwards of 3 to 3.5 years before they consider the patient return to the community. And I'd note that I haven't indicated that they were cured, because many of the experts within the field do not believe that people are truly ever cured of this problem. It's the intent of our intent through House Bill 2543 to allow the defendants, the persons convicted of these crimes, to be placed on or given a sentence that will, if they are incarcerated, entitle the Corrections Division to continue them on supervision beyond the time they're to be released according to their time span under what's now the sentencing guidelines. Or if a court finds that a person does not warrant long-term incarceration but is in need of very serious treatment and supervision, the court, upon reviewing all the facts and all the circumstances pertaining to both the defendant and the case, can extend the imposition or suspend the imposition of sentence or execution and place them on probation for up to the maximum statutory indeterminate sentence for the offense. That's how the bill would shake out.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Parks.
You say that if the court finds that they're a dangerous offender, I don't see where that's in the bill, and maybe that's someplace else.
Representative Parks, if I said that, I misspoke myself. It's if the court feels that they are capable of treatment and therefore not a dangerous offender, and they may then place them on probation. This isn't really within the bill. I'm giving you the factual scenario of what would happen. But the court would now have the leeway, if this bill were passed, to say, take someone who's convicted of rape in the first degree. The court may now only place them on probation for 5 years. The court may decide, based upon the experts that have been provided, that the person is not amenable to the Oregon State Penitentiary, but should be treated and should be monitored long term. This act would allow the judge to place that person on probation for up to 20 years.
And a further question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Park.
On line 10, do you have the bill there with you?
Yes, sir.
Well, on line 10, it says the court shall place the defendant on probation for a period of 5 years. That's a minimum.
Correct.
Okay. And no more than the maximum statutory indeterminate sentence. What is that for these offenses?
The maximum statutory indeterminate sentence for these offenses is 20 years, with the exception of sexual abuse in the first degree as it now exists. Now, one of the other bills that we have proposed would actually raise the cap of that to a 10-year sentence.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Learned Counsel.
Jim, you said that the court may do this, but on line 5 it says that the court shall that any person sentenced to a term of imprisonment shall serve a term of post-prison supervision equal to. Do you intend this to be discretionary, or do you intend it to be mandatory?
It is the intent of the bill for that portion to be mandatory. And that follows, and I unintentionally blended the two, and you're correct, because the first section is where the court has already given, and this is no different than what the statutory schemes are now. When the court sentences a defendant to the Oregon State Corrections Division, the court loses discretion as to the disposition of that defendant. Under this section, that loss of discretion stays. Okay, once the court determines that the defendant is to serve a prison term, then the corrections division, pursuant to the statutes and the rules, will set a post-prison supervision time, and now that post-prison supervision term should be equal to the maximum statutory indeterminate sentence.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Mr. Spencer?
I'd just like to add, in addressing a comment that Representative Mannix made regarding the fiscal impact of this bill, we anticipate that it will not be as great as one might initially suspect, because many of the people subject to these provisions, the pedophiles and the molesters, typically are employable and can pay their own fees. And Chief Deputy Robson will address that further.
Thank you very much. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, you may have already said this and I may have missed it, but in the case of rape that has a 20-year sentence,
yes,
possibility, if a person was convicted of that, could he be sentenced and spend, say, 19 years in prison and then get out and spend then 20 more years from that date under supervision?
No, it would be equal to the maximum statutory indeterminate sentence. The way that by law that would be calculated is he would have served 19 years in custody. The 1 year remaining would be post-prison supervision. That would be the expiration of the term.
Okay. Looking at the wording here, it just says that the person shall serve a post-prison supervision equal to the maximum statutory sentence. Which tells me you go to wherever it is that lays out the maximum statutory sentence, and that's the 20 years. So I think the way this is worded, it's at least ambiguous as to whether or not it's supposed to be attacking or not. If I'm incorrect, then
there are a number of statutory enactments that are triggered when any time any criminal defendant is sentenced. This merely addresses one section of those statutes. There are statutes and administrative rules which govern the overall application and term setting of maximum statutory times, and they would not be affected, as I understand this bill. So
we're looking to an administrative rule to clarify a statute?
No, sir. If you give me a moment, I'll have to go to the sentencing statutes.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I can come back to this if you...
Okay. Like to do Thank that. You very much. Mr. Robson, Mr. McCloskey, and Ms. Gustafson.
Until the end of the maximum would do better. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I think Representative Johnson's point is well made. It probably should say something like until the end of or something like that. We can deal with that in work session. But I think that the equal to could lead someone to read that as an add-on rather than.
On its face, that's what it says now. But it wouldn't be hard to change. I think we can deal
Thank
with
you.
That. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stan Robson. I'm Chief Criminal Deputy for the Benton County Sheriff's Department. I've been in law enforcement for just over 20 years, and 14 of which I was an investigator of crimes against persons, most of which were child abuse and sexual exploitation of children. I feel very strongly about this particular bill. In fact, when I started in on the task force, I recommended lifetime probation on much of it, but it settled for a little bit less. In that, as Mr. McIntyre alluded to earlier, there is no cure for the sex offender known today. And as was reported by Dr. Bolstad, who testified earlier on another committee, many of the experts in the field feel the same way. But there are controls that can be set up and have been successful in probationary situations. And Detective McCloskey will testify in just a minute, performs many of the polygraphs for these individuals. One of the things that we find is that many of these people are very controllable under supervision, and that when there is the responsibility of polygraph and other sanctions to be had during this time, they do correct their ways or at least maintain pretty good lifestyles under when they know they're being monitored. When they once get past probationary situations, we end up picking these individuals up again for similar offenses. One of the aspects that we also tried to take in consideration with this is we knew it would be physical impact would be the number one thing. So I did do some research on our local situation where parole and probation is under the Sheriff's Department. And right now we have 64 or 63 offenders under supervision. 48 are employed. 4 of them are part-time employed. 2 of them are college students. 2 of them are disabled. And it leaves only 7 that are unemployed. And as we've found out during this process, many years of looking at these individuals, they do pay their way. They are employable individuals. They do pay for the polygraph examinations, and they do pay their way for supervision. Now, on this extended probation, we know that they would probably be lessened in that they wouldn't be under intense supervision after a period of time. But even putting down into a low level, they would still have to come to the office on a monthly basis for reporting purposes, and then also having to go through the process of certain employment, certain living situations as to when they move, and these types of things would have to be approved. And with the polygraph responsibility continuing during this particular period of time, we think it would be important and could necessitate, or I should say mandate, or monitor more closely what is going on in their life at that particular time. By being able to control these individuals longer and setting up better control situations for them, maybe we can deal with their lifestyle, monitor it enough, or modify it enough, they wouldn't be seeking out the proximity of children. I'm going to ask Detective McCloskey to give a little bit further on control basis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry McCloskey. I'm a detective with the Benton County Sheriff's Office. I'm also a licensed polygraph examiner. I've been employed by the Sheriff's Office in Benton County for approximately 18 and a half years. For the past 5 years, I have been directly involved in sex offender treatment on an ongoing basis. I conduct variably from 100 to 200 polygraph examinations and interviews each year with convicted sex offenders. One thing that is extremely clear to me is that statistically I can prove any polygraph examiner who deals with sex offenders can statistically prove that sex offenders perform extremely well while on probation. Chief Deputy Robson has indicated that we do have a concern, of course, and express concern in terms of their performance after probation. Unfortunately, we don't have the imposed conscience that the polygraph provides to follow up with those who are no longer on probation to determine whether, in fact, they have been successful or not. Successful, from their perspective, may mean that they don't get caught again. And obviously, after they've been caught one time, they're going to be more successful at not doing that in the future. The polygraph provides an opportunity for us to require that they tell on themselves. Now, regardless of your own position in terms of how you feel about polygraph, specifically, this bill, as it is introduced here, provides an opportunity for whatever form of supervision to occur and continue for an extended period of time. I've dealt with some offenders who have been in treatment for as long as 4 to 5 years who, on exiting treatment, express serious concern about their own ability to control their behaviors. I can recall specifically about a year and a half ago talking to one such individual who had continued treatment at his own expense, at his own volition. After his period of probation, I talked to him within sight of the Capitol building right here. He provided information as a result of that continued treatment of his own choice that resulted in our breaking what may be one of the most infamous institutional child abuse cases in the state of Oregon at the Children's Farm Home. That was a result of one person's dedication to continuing treatment to the point where he was able to obtain the benefit to himself and potentially to a myriad of other children. Most offenders, however, don't have the personal dedication to do that. I really feel that this bill meets a very sincerely determined need and expressed need, and speaking as an investigator and speaking as an adjunct to sex offender treatment, I feel that it really does address a serious need here, and I would ask the committee to very favorably consider this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Ms. McCloskey?
I'm sorry. Ms. Gustafson.
Yes. I'm Christy Gustafson. I'm a deputy with Multnomah County Sheriff's Department. I'm also a detective there, currently working sex crimes. Very simply, there's nothing more frustrating than working a sex crimes case involving a repeat offender that has molested children in the past and is your prime suspect. When you go to check the person's record and you find that the person has a record, he is no longer incarcerated, he did a very short amount of time, and not only is he not incarcerated, but he's not on any kind of supervision at all. That's something that occurs time and time again, and it certainly needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much. Elise Claussen.
Thank you, Chairman Mandelera and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elise Claussen. I'm the Assistant Director of the Community Services Branch of the Department of Corrections. I am passing out some written testimony and will not read from that testimony, but will just comment on a couple of things that have been discussed here. First of all, the Department of Corrections does support the need to expand supervision time of the more serious sex offenders in the community. We supported it when that topic was looked at by the governor's task force and have supported it within the department. We recognize that it is a need. We also agree with the testimony that has been given that many sex offenders do very well on supervision and probation in the community if they are continued in supervision, and particularly if they are also involved in treatment programs and are given periodic polygraph exams. In most of those programs, we do expect that the offender themselves pay for the polygraph, and in many cases that occurs. It does not, I don't believe, occur in all cases. There are some offenders who are unable to pay that cost. The supervision fee issue, currently you probably know by statute that all offenders who are under supervision of the Department of Corrections are expected to pay a $25 a month supervision fee, which can be waived or reduced by the court of the department based on their ability to pay. The $25 a month supervision fee that we collect, just so that people here understand how that works, I suspect most of you do, if you're involved in Ways and Means at all, is that essentially we project how much we will collect over a biennium, and it is considered part of our budget as an other funds category. So if we are given, say, $39 million for probation and parole supervision, and we collect in a biennium $2 million of supervision fees, that is part of our total budget, and it's from all offenders. It's not specified to any one group. It is included as part of our budget. So that fee is currently being paid. I'd also mention that in California and Washington, my understanding is that they have shorter periods of supervision and have done some of the long-term management by using registration, which was talked about in a previous committee on another bill. Again, I guess I would just like to say that we do support conceptually this, but we do believe there's a substantial fiscal impact and that we could not accommodate this extended supervision given our existing resources. Exactly what that fiscal impact would be is something that would have to be worked out, but because we're not sure exactly what it would be. Some portions of this bill would not hit immediately, would not hit for a period of time, but there is some long-term fiscal impact on the department in order to carry out this bill, and for that reason, we just need to let you know that we would be unable to comply with this currently within our existing resources, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Fundamentally, you certainly support the policy advanced in this bill. You're just unable to commit that you can do it given
the resources
what you think
have.
Is a shortage of resources.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's accurate.
And let me just ask an informational question. In your third paragraph, say the current length of supervision time for sex offenders on probation or post-prison supervision is 3 years. I was under the impression that the supervision time for probation was 5 years. Is that
it previously was 5 years. Under sentencing guidelines, the maximum time is 3 years. But there are a number of people still in our system that are on for 5 years. And I think there are also provisions within sentencing guidelines for the judge to extend the time.
Correct. Is there one other question? Is there anything to be said? Probably difficult to calculate. Your final paragraph, extended supervision time on certain sex offenders will have a long-term fiscal impact. You haven't said whether that's positive or negative. I guess I'm understanding from your perspective that maybe that's negative. Let me ask, is there anything to be said for the fact that maybe some of the offenders you now house or have to deal with won't be reentering the system? And if so, how do you calculate that?
Well, that is a possibility that they may, you mean if they are out,
if they're
either on
off,
probation that they would never go to prison, or if they're on post-prison supervision that they may not come back because
or
of
may
the
not come back in such a costly fashion, I guess. Is
yeah,
the
and that's that would be difficult to calculate.
Do you expect that's a possibility?
It may be a possibility, but I really would not be prepared, at least at this point, to say what that might be. And in terms of the long-term fiscal impact, it is a negative fiscal impact in the sense that what would happen is the number of sex offenders, when you start increasing it 5, 10, and 20 years, just starts building up, and so you'd have substantially more offenders on supervision than you would have had that supervision expired in 3 years.
More offenders on supervision, but if I understood the previous testimony, more former offenders who aren't reoffending. We hope. Those who apparently the testimony is, and maybe you disagree with it, that those who are on supervision perform better in society when on supervision as opposed to going off supervision.
I believe that is a theory that is advanced by treatment professionals and may be accurate, yes. What I don't know is whether or not we can calculate that. I don't know.
You sound a little skeptical about that theory.
Well, I believe that from the conversation that we've had from the treatment providers that we worked with and the parole and probation officers who carry sex offender caseloads, we know that there are a substantial number of sex offenders who do well while they're under supervision. Our data system doesn't tell us what happens after they're off, so I can't make that as a conclusive statement. But I can say that they do well while they're under supervision, or a number of them do. Some do, some do not.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bryan.
At least under ORS 423-570, where the Department of Corrections can, as part of a release plan, require the fee. The fee's not limited to $25. Is it? It's a minimum of $25. Is that correct?
It just said as a $25 fee. In theory, which I suspect you're asking, Mr. Chairman and Representative Bryan, is that could the parole board, for instance, and post-prison supervision board increase that fee, and then could it be targeted specifically at paying for those sex offender supervision?
That would be of interest to me. The statute would read that the fee must be $25 and minimum, and if it isn't set, then it's automatically $25. But I don't see any restrictions on making it more than $25, particularly let's say after, for example, maybe after the 3-year period where this bill would take its effect. Right now, they'd be on 3 years anyway. So maybe after 3 years, when we're getting into this, shall we say, bonus time, at that point, maybe the fees could be structured to have increased. Maybe by that time, these people are employed and resuming somewhat normal life. And I guess that's the issue, is can the fees be structured in a lot of these cases at that point, after giving a 3 years lead time, to better support their own program, their own supervision?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, perhaps, and I would need to look at the statute on supervision fees. It is set at $25, and what it provides for is a waiver of reducing it or waiving it altogether. I don't know that it says maximum. I'd have to look at that statute. So I don't have that in front of me. But if you're correct on the statute, then yes, that could be done, I suppose, within the offender's ability to pay, and that's how it's usually determined by the court and the Board of Post-Prison Supervision.
I would have expected that, learned counsel. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The registration option that you mentioned briefly, I understand that's being dealt with currently in another bill, so there is not a registration system in Oregon right now.
Chairman Miller, Representative Johnson, yes, there is a statute currently. It was passed last biennium to register sex offenders for anyone who is under supervision of the Department of Corrections, and to continue that registration for 5 years after release from supervision, and that is on the books today. There is a bill to amend that statute to expand it and to create it, essentially the lifetime provision.
Lifetime registration,
right.
Provision.
But we do have it currently for the time period I just mentioned.
And I assume that registration is cheaper than supervision.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, registration is essentially putting the information into the computer and then just updating it based on the address change.
Okay. There's been mentioned a couple different times about how these people, other than as opposed to a normal criminal, are able to support themselves and pay for some of their supervision costs. Maybe I'm missing something, but I don't see anything in this bill that specifically directs any court or anybody else to require that these people pay for their post-supervision costs. Is there something somewhere else that gives them the right or the power to? Well, I'm sorry. There's a sentence that refers to it. Is that a mandatory thing?
It says shall be paid.
Okay.
Mandatory.
And that, does that take care of your concerns? she's saying that they don't have money to pay for it.
It might, if in fact they can actually pay for that, if we could determine that could in fact be paid and collected, and what we'd have to determine the cost.